Pushkin.
I found myself skipping at home. You know, I'm 6'1", and I am a pretty gigantic Black person, but I had so much joy in that moment that I literally could not contain it. And I skipped down the entire hallway of my grandmother's house, and I was like, oh, I just skipped down that whole hallway, huh? Okay, I'm feeling myself. I'm feeling good. So it was just those physical changes were really great. You know, it was, I don't know. That was a very magical golden honeymoon period of being a trans man.
Morgan Givens was assigned female at birth. In his 20s, he underwent hormone therapy to bring his body into alignment with his male gender identity. Initially, he felt profound joy and liberation. But he said that feeling was short-lived when he was confronted with the reality of being a Black man in society.
You know, there was this aspect of feeling completely boxed in and caged by womanhood and my femininity. And I broke free of that, you know? I broke free of it for a little while. I had a few moments in the sun, you know? But the longer I've gone since that moment, the more I've realized how I have become caged once again. I'm not as free as I thought I was.
I'm Maya Shunker, and this is A Slight Change of Plans, a show that dives deep into the world of change and hopefully gets us to think differently about change in our own lives. Morgan, I was wondering if you could take me back to the day when you started taking testosterone.
Yeah. So this doctor that I went to in that moment was like just a little piece of magic to me because he held the key to me helping unlock the rest of who I am or like stepping into myself fully. And I could not wait for him to give it to me. I was just like, hurry up and give it to me. Also, I could go home and be too scared to use it, you know? But and so I was excited, but kind of scared. And one of my good friends, she was like, why are you being such a baby? I'm like, I'm not being a baby, but like, you know, that's a needle, man. That's a needle. I'm gonna have to do it myself. And she was like, okay, cool. And like, she disappeared for like 3 minutes. And then she came back and just jabbed me in the leg. I was like, wait a minute. And she was like, there you go. I gave you your first T-shot. And I was like, oh, I guess it's not that scary. It's not that bad.
And can you describe your reaction when you first started to notice the effects of the testosterone?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I was geeked. You know, I thought I was fly, too, you know, because my voice started dropping. So I started answering the phone like, how y'all doing? Hey, how you doing? Hey, girl. Hello. Hello. Yeah. And I was just and my mom was like, who do you think you are? Why you got all these women calling you? I didn't raise you like this. You think because your voice getting deep, you can, you know? And so I had to really kind of step back a bit, but I was just very, very ecstatic about it because my voice started dropping quickly, you know? I got really strong. Anything that I could pick up, if it wasn't nailed down, I was going to, especially if it was heavy and it looked like a challenge. I was lifting my mama. I was lifting trash cans and I was just doing random things. Like I worked at Target at the time. I worked in retail, had just kind of come out of college. They'd be like, who's going to take out the trash? I'm like, I got y'all. I had never, ever volunteered to take out the trash before in my life. But yeah, every time I think about it, it makes me smile. You know, I was in a honeymoon phase, very much so.
Do you have any other specific memories of watching your voice and body change in those early months?
You know, there was this weight that I hadn't realized I had been carrying moving through the world and the world seeing me as this young Black woman. Because at the time I started taking testosterone and I began hormone replacement. And I just noticed that I was letting down my guard in ways that I never would have done before. Like, you know, there's one time I was leaving work and I used to work this late shift at Target, and I would leave and it'd be pitch black by myself at like 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning. And so I was always before I started taking testosterone and these changes started happening, I was very cautious. I was incredibly cautious about any time I was alone at night. But I realized that I didn't feel afraid. And I realized how light it felt to not carry that fear of gendered violence. And I had not really, I guess it's hard to recognize something you live with so constantly. But the freedom that came with this masculine presentation, I guess I would say, and this, the way people assume I'm a cis man, I haven't felt that type of tension in my shoulders since, you know, because it all just kind of released from my body. Like, I didn't carry my keys in my hand as though I could use them as a weapon whenever I needed to. And I stopped doing that. And it was something I stopped doing without realizing it.
I'm wondering if you can tell me about some of the first times you noticed that people were starting to treat you differently because of your gender.
Oh, yeah. You know, and so much of this was really happening at Target. You know, Target is a microcosm of society. You know, you meet all kinds of people in there. You really do. All kinds of employees, all kinds of people coming in there to say they're going to get one thing and leave with 20. You know, like, so my job at Target, you know, I put the things on the shelf. I was program designers. They tried to give us fancy names. So I was like, I'm just putting stuff on the shelf. And so Anna, who was my boss, my team lead, you know, she had the experience. I deferred to Anna, you know, because she respected me. I respected her. Like, you got more experience than I do. Okay, cool. But this young white manager came in and he could not handle her telling him no, you know. And if I said the same thing, I mean, we could be standing in a circle and Anna could say something and he would act like he didn't hear her. He would speak over her and I would repeat it. And he'd be like, oh, well, you know, Morgan, that's quite a good idea. And I would have to go, Anna said it. You know, this was Anna's idea. And, you know, and when I saw that so clearly, because it just made me mad, because it made me realize how often it had been done to me before. And so that was one of the first moments where I was like, okay, and now it's in my face, you know? And it was just disheartening in a way, irritating, and also exhausting for selfish reasons, because it's like, I have to say something. It's like, now you're interrupting my day because I have to talk to you.
Had your manager known you before your transition? Or So tell me more about that, right? Did you really see him change through your transition start giving you more respect and deference?
Yes, that's the wildest part, is that people at that job who knew me before, who knew me as Morgan, assuming that I was a cis woman, they were like, oh, yes. But as soon as my voice started dropping, as soon as my shoulders started getting a little broad, all of a sudden they acted like the bass in my voice meant what I had to say was more important. Or they started suggesting that I get extra shifts. Or they started being like, why don't you apply to be a manager? I didn't hear them asking any of the women. And I asked some of my women, did they ask you to apply to be a manager? Some people who were just as good as I was at the job and better. And they were like, no, I didn't even know we was going to be looking for managers. So those were the types of things that would happen.
Well, it also seems like they didn't ask you to be a manager a year prior.
No. Like, just, it was gradual. I noticed it in increments, but because it was so outside the realm of what I had experienced before, it always stood out. Those little moments just always stood out. So it's just those little things, you know, and those things accumulate over a person's lifetime.
Were there parts of you that, you know, kind of privately enjoyed the benefits that came along with this new perception?
Yes, and that's the hardest part, you know, because it does make your life easier. That the hard part is seeing those benefits and saying no to them. They're right there.
You know, you've talked about how people treated you differently in response to your being a man and that it came along with benefits. I want to know what it was like to be perceived as a Black man. Do you remember the first time you faced this new reality?
Yeah, the first time was when I had to deal with a cop outside of my grandmother's house, you know. You know, I was coming home from work, and one of those late nights, fully out of my androgynous phase of the taking testosterone, and I pulled up in front of my grandmother's house. She had this really nice home in this beautiful neighborhood. You know, one of those neighborhoods where we were kind of the only pepper in the salt shaker, at least that's how we kind of put it. So, you know, I pull up in the driveway, mind you, backed up into the driveway, and this sheriff's deputy, you know, I saw him when he drove past me to the right, and I saw him see me as I was backing into the driveway. And then he flips around, you know, there's a little cul-de-sac at the end. He comes creeping slowly back up, you know, kind of rolls to a stop, you know, hops out of the car. I'm already out of the car, you know, because I'm going in the house. This is where I live. This is my home. And he looks at me. He goes, do you live here? What are you doing here? And I'm looking at him like, what do you mean? What am I doing here? I live here. What are you doing here? Because at this point, you're standing on our property and I didn't call you. And I was like, well, I live here. And I could see, you can always tell an antsy person. You can tell a scared person, you know, and scared people do ridiculous things. Scared people do racist things, you know, and in that moment, it's so irritating to have to pacify him so I can stay safe. I'm like, I'm literally having to treat you like a child so that I'm okay. I can't call my grandmother because I know what she's going to do. She's going to come out of the house and she's going to raise hell. Last thing I want is for something to happen to her. Last thing I want is for some harm to come to her, because what she will not stand for is seeing me threatened in any way. He goes, well, we've had some car break-ins over here. And now, come on now. I knew the man was lying, because this was one of those rich neighborhoods. If somebody knocked over a mailbox, they would have put out a newsletter. They would have been like, y'all, we got people breaking mailboxes. So I was like, this man is lying. You know, and so he tells me, put your hands on the hood of the car. And I know there's no reason for me to be putting my hands on the hood of the car, because he has no legitimate reason to be fearful. I've told him I live here. And if he had any sense, he could have run the tag and seen that it was attached to the home where I'm at. And I think what made me so angry was the fact that I could not fight back in the way that I wanted to, because that right there, you know, it was the punctuation mark. It was like a period. It was a pause on all that joy I had been feeling. Because for him to roll up on my house, treat me the way he did, speak to me the way he did, lie to me, make me put my hands on the hood of the car like I was somehow involved in criminal activity, is dehumanizing, you know? And it's also painful. And that's the thing they try to take from us, is all of our emotions. You know, don't feel the pain, get angry. You know, don't feel the pain, harden yourself to it. But that's painful. And yes, my reaction in those moments is anger, but my anger is masking that pain. It's masking that dehumanization. And, you know, there was this aspect of feeling completely boxed in and caged by womanhood and my femininity. And I broke free of that, you know, I broke free of it for a little while. I had a few moments in the sun, you know, but the longer I've gone since that moment, the more I've realized how I have become caged once again. I'm not as free as I thought I was.
We'll be right back with a slight change of plans. About a year after Morgan Givens was confronted by that police officer, he decided to move to Washington, D.C. to start afresh. He considered a few different jobs, but ultimately decided to follow in his grandma's footsteps. She had been a police officer, and Morgan decided to become one too, a decision he did not take lightly.
So I spent a lot of time kind of standing over who the police are in reality and what I wanted them to be, which is not what they're not that, you know, but because I grew up with my grandmother who was a cop for 30 years, I've always had this complex relationship with police and authority because I know my grandma, right? She baked cookies and then she went and put her uniform. I remember laying on the couch and she would go put her uniform on and walk out the door. And I'd be like, bye, grandma. And she'd be like, there's cookies on the counter, you know, stuff like that.
Did you grow up with cops coming in and out of the house?
Yeah, they were in the house all the time. We had cookouts. These were people who I found to be kind and warm and funny, you know, and these were people. When my grandmother's friends came in the house, I can't remember ever seeing my grandmother's cop friends in their uniforms. What I saw were the people outside of their jobs as a child, you know? And so I saw them through the eyes of a child. And my father at that time was physically abusive. And I remember one time my brother and I ran up the stairs to tell the neighbors something was happening in the house. And that was one of the last straws, I think. And my grandmother called her friends, and those cops came and they packed up all of our stuff right then and drove all of it to our grandma's house. And so I have this emotional remembrance of safety in those moments that does not coincide with reality. And so I think part of what I had to do was grow out of the safety I felt around particular cops as a child in order to see policing in its fullness.
What were your goals in entering the force?
When I joined the police department, you know, I was not running in there being like, you know, these people are fantastic. They're angels. They got wings. Like I knew the history of policing. I knew where it started. I knew its origins in slave catching patrols and how it kind of blossomed from there. You know, I understood how it worked in communities and how it didn't work in white communities the same way it works in black and brown ones. And I would read about how people were treated who were trans and queer. And at that point in my life, I joined because I said, if police say they are here to protect the public, then that's what we should be doing. But we need to expand the idea of what that protection means and what we're actually saying when we talk about protecting people. And so I was like, okay, I can go in there and, you know, I guess I can work my way up in the ranks. And maybe when I'm at a certain position, you know, I can help, you know, I can do something. I can tweak some things, but at the end of it's like a tweak. Even at that time, I was saying to myself, I can tweak some things, not realizing I was saying tweak, not fix. Mm. So it's like at the end of the day, part of me seems to have recognized the impossibility of the task, the Audre Lorde quote that we hear all the time, boy, you gonna take them tools and try to dismantle whose house, you know? And so, but part of me wanted to make policing be what it says it is, but is not.
So you were the first openly trans policeman in the DC workforce. How did you approach those conversations and how were you received by the force? Had you always planned to be open about that?
I went into the academy with the intention of being open about it because I do recognize the psychology of how people's hearts soften when they know someone, even if they don't like that person. I was like, all right, if I'm open in the academy, you know, and they get to know me, it will influence and impact how they interact with trans people they meet on the streets, because their understanding of who we are is not based in the lies told about us. I was hoping that they would remember a little piece of me when they interacted with people. And I had this guy who trained us. You know, I remember he met me and we went through the entire week. And after I graduated, you know, he came up to me and he's like, you were like one of the best recruits we've had. And, you know, I just wanted to let you know that, like, you really changed me. You changed how I view things and how I go through the world. And I was just really kind of blown away because this was like this gruff, middle-aged white guy who'd been doing this for quite some time. And he was just very rough around the edges. But I was very, very meticulous about how I came out in the academy and who knew what when. So by the time I came out 3 months into the academy to my classmates, they knew me. And so it wasn't, oh, there's a trans guy in our class. They're like, oh, Morgan's here and he's trans.
You know, I imagine certain police forces can foster a kind of macho, bro-y culture.
Oh, yes.
I mean, yeah, so first, was that the case? And were you included in that bro culture? And importantly, did you want to be?
Oh, man. So, yes, it was the case. There was this... It was very much machismo. It was very much, you know, all the worst traits of quote unquote masculinity that you could kind of put into a blender and hand a powerful badge to and a weapon. And it was when I want to be specific because the masculinity part, this this tough guy thing was this idea of power and containment, that you do not back down no matter what because you're the cop. And I didn't want to be part of that, because my whole goal was, that's not how we should be doing it. I would honestly, you know, actually get clowned a little bit because I did not arrest as many people, or I would do more talking on my scenes. And if I come at them with the way we've been taught, gruffly, you know, screaming, don't back down, be a man, quote unquote, it's not going to make the situation better. It's not going to solve the issue. And so it was there, but it wasn't something that I sought to be a part of, but I was not excluded.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you found yourself learning anything new about masculinity from being in the police force, if it changed your relationship with it.
It did, because it made me treat it not as precious as I had before. Like, I think that was me beginning to step more away from the traditional ideal of masculinity, you know, being gruff and stoic and emotion, what's that? You know, and kind of, do I want to act as though this doesn't affect me? Do I want to act as though I don't know what joy is? Do I want to behave in those ways? And so it pushed me further away from the traditional idea of masculinity. That was me beginning to take the path to, I think, just being me. Because we have to communicate, because we have to know how to talk to one another, we have to label things. We have to label actions that are just human actions, things that we just do that are just inherently human. We label them masculine, feminine. That started me on that journey of, why does it matter? You know, who cares?
Why did you end up deciding to leave the police force?
Gosh, I had been on the police department for almost 3 years, and I was just tired. Also just facing reality, you know, just facing the uphill battle, facing how insurmountable that was, realizing that policing would change me before I could change it. Because if you wear a costume long enough, you start to think it's your real clothes, you know? And so you wear this costume of masculinity on the job. But if you're on the job 24/7 and you spend so much time in uniform, you can definitely lose yourself in the mask that you have to put on to wear. And I did not like that. You know, I had to leave. There was nothing left for me to do there except lose myself.
I see. I'd love to zoom out and ask you a few questions about how you've been processing your transition over the years. You know, your story leads me to question this idea that we can really change on our own terms, right? I mean, it's hard enough to make that initial change within ourselves, but then you realize that there's this huge second hurdle to navigate, which is that our society will invariably respond differently to you now that you've made that change, right? You know, based on going through this experience, do you think this notion of changing on our own terms is just a fiction we've created to help us feel a greater sense of, you know, personal agency in our lives? And have you felt yourself hitting the limits of that agency?
I cannot, you know, as you've said, I can't control how other people respond to me. I cannot control how other people treat me, you know, but even in the midst of that destabilization, even in the midst of these variables that I cannot control, I can still maintain my grip on myself.
Did you ever feel like you were losing parts of yourself that you valued because you had to?
I almost did. I almost, because I am actually quite sensitive. and I don't know. I like the things that people might say are things that women enjoy. I tend to have mostly women friends. Like, I don't mind having those deep emotional conversations, but there was a moment where I was like, oh, this is not what men do. So there was a full almost 8 months to a year where I was like, I guess I need to find some cis guy friends. You know, if this is how I'm going to be, I guess I have to release everything that was. I almost lost so many pieces of myself trying to fit into this this idea of what I thought masculinity was before I accepted it's whatever I say it is, you know? And it kind of forced me to think more deeply about who I am and how I build myself and who I want to be. Because if I can dismantle my gender and rebuild it, why can I not dismantle other parts and rebuild those too? And so it helped me unchain the parts of myself that I thought I had to hide to protect them. And it's like, well, you can come out now. Trust that I am at a place where I can keep you safe enough. I can keep myself safe enough. I can sit with myself in safety and own all the parts of me. You know what? I'm gonna text him. I'm sorry. Mason Bubby, I'm doing an interview, man. I gotta call you back, okay? Okay. Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. If you're enjoying A Slight Change of Plans, please make sure to subscribe, rate, and share the show with friends. And join me next week when I talk with Ramzi Kabaz. When he was a college student, he woke up to what sounded like a blaring fire alarm.
And then it took me a few seconds to realize that the sound actually wasn't coming from anywhere. It was coming from inside my own head. And, you know, at that point, I knew that there was something super wrong.
Do you have a slight change of plan story you'd like to share? Leave a message on our change hotline at 917-544-8977. It could just end up on a future episode of our show. That's 917-544-8977. You can also follow us on Twitter at Slight Change Pod. A Slight Change of Plans is created, co-written, and executive produced by me, Maya Shunker. It's produced and co-written by Mo Labori. Our associate producer is David Jaw. Executive producers are Mia LaBelle and Justine Lang. Editor is Jen Guerra. Sound design and mix engineering by Ben Tolliday. Our theme song is I Can Change by Lake Street Dive. Original music for the series by Jason Gambrell. Additional music from Epidemic Sound. And of course, a very special thanks to Jimmy Lee. To learn more about A Slight Change of Plans and to sign up for our newsletter, visit pushkin.fm. You can also follow at Pushkin Pods on social media. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.